kitchen table. Rhys focused the heat lamp on the bed sheet and then moved to a table farther away from the concoction he had just created, presumably to limit the damage in case the next batch did not go as planned. From her vantage point, it was difficult for Liz to tell what he was doing. She could see him mixing shots of what appeared to be the pool and concrete cleaners with nail polish remover into the chemistry glassware, swirling it around and then pouring it into a coffee filter he had secured over a round bottom flask. She could tell he was being as meticulous as possible during this portion of the process, and she wondered whether this was the part where terrorists sometimes unintentionally exploded. With pliers, he pulled the bullet out of a 5.56mm cartridge case and poured the powder on the table. Liz was transfixed, thinking that at any moment she might watch as the man she was closest to in this world entered the next. From a string of red, green, yellow, and blue Christmas tree lights, Rhys cut a single bulb, heating up the end with a candle before dipping it into water to break off the tip. She knew this was a delicate part of the procedure as she watched Rhys pack the cartridge case with his newly created mixture and place the broken light inside, securing it with hot glue. It dawned on her that from elements that usually brought happiness and joy, Christmas and swimming pools, Rhys was brewing up a mixture of death. When he was done, Rhys stood and slowly moved away from the table. He looked tired and relieved. "That went well," he said. "The good old Mujahideen slam, and we're even still alive."
"Well, wonders never cease,"
Liz replied, obviously as relieved as he was. "It will take at least overnight to dry the urea nitrate on the bed sheets. That's the equivalent of TNT and will be the primary explosive. The heat lamp should help speed up the process. The dangerous part is done. Tomorrow I'll pack the PVC pipe with the explosive and place the copper bowl under the collar. Set the firing cap I just made into the back, and attach the light bulb to the wireless doorbell. Not bad for an amateur."
"I'm just glad we are all still in one piece," Liz stated.
"Me too. Let's get some rest. Over the next few days, we're going to need it." Chapter 68. New York, New York. Anthony Craig did not like his job. Well, it wasn't his job per se, it was the person his job required him to drive around New York that he disliked. As a young black kid growing up in Brooklyn in the 1960s and 70s, he had been headed down a dark path. That was until his father took a day off from his janitorial duties at an investment bank on Wall Street, something Anthony could only remember him doing that one time in order to take him to lunch. Instead of getting a bite to eat, they had walked to the Marine Corps recruiting office on Chambers Street. The Marines had knocked the chip off his shoulder and turned his life around. After his father's early death from a heart attack, Anthony left the Corps and returned home to New York City. He married a woman whom he'd met at church, and they raised two children, who were both now in college on academic scholarships. Now in his mid-50s, he was proud of the life he had created. He was not proud of the man he was driving around. It wasn't that J.D. Hartley treated him poorly. In fact, it was just the opposite. Despite Hartley's philandering, he was generally well-liked by everyone. Hartley was at a point in his life where his adultery was a part of his persona and even an element of his national identity. He had been elected to Congress from the great state of California despite being caught red-handed on multiple occasions in compromising situations, both financial and extramarital. But what was acceptable in California was not palatable to a national electorate. After a failed presidential election bid, he had let his wife take the spotlight as she worked her way through positions of power all the way up to Secretary of Defense. J.D. had occupied himself running his consulting company, lobbying and building his foundation, with the mission of bringing computers and education to the Third World. This allowed him to attend fundraisers where he was the toast of the evening, surrounded by adoring women who found his mischievous ways intensely alluring. What offended Anthony wasn't the lifestyle or elitism of his current employer.
It was the fact that J.D. Hartley had assumed from day one that because Anthony was black, he was by default a liberal Democrat and supportive of the Hartleys' political leanings. Anthony had seen liberal policies fail his community time and time again, promoting an entitlement culture that he believed was the cause of the problems rather than the solution to them. In any event, Anthony was a man of God and a professional. He smiled and made small talk when necessary, always on time, and always gassed up and ready to go. Today his boss had made him wait longer than usual. Anthony had parked the Suburban right in front of the Soho apartment where Hartley had spent the night with his latest mistress, a well-endowed real estate agent in her early 30s. He must have really been on a roll as he'd spent the entire day with her in the apartment building, finally calling for Anthony in the late afternoon. The doorman allowed Anthony to park in the loading zone while he waited for the former congressman. Anthony had the satellite radio set to a classical music station as he surveyed the Manhattan evening. He loved the hustle of New York and would never think of working elsewhere. The vitality of the people moving along the sidewalks, the constant stream of traffic, and the majesty of the buildings never got old for him. It was his city. The melancholy of Richard Strauss's Im Abendrot filled the Suburban. Anthony loved classical music almost as much as he loved New York. Pairing the two was majestic. Knowing that the piece was written with the calm acceptance of death as its inspiration seemed in sharp contrast with the life surrounding Anthony's current piece of early evening New York energy. A wave from the doorman signified that Congressman Hartley was headed down. Anthony exited his vehicle, pushing the heavy armored door open, and moved to the right rear passenger side to open the door as Hartley exited the building with a spring in his step.
"Good evening, Anthony," Hartley said with a confident smile full of
magnificent white teeth as he approached the car in an immaculate navy blue suit and bright yellow tie.
"Sorry to keep you waiting, but duty called."
"Good evening, Congressman,"
Anthony replied as he opened the door for his employer, shutting it behind him and making his way around the front. The black Sprinter van almost knocked him off his feet.
"Whoa,"
Anthony stammered as he regained his balance.
"Hey,"
he yelled at the Sprinter driver. The van had pulled in right next to the congressman's Suburban, so close that it had knocked the left side view mirror off the vehicle.
"These young delivery guys are crazy,"
thought Anthony, bringing his arms up in an incredulous shrug as if to say, "Well, now what?" As he moved back to the front of the Suburban, he got a good look at the driver of the van. With a full beard and unkempt hair, he looked more like a mountain man than a delivery driver. It was when he slid from the front seat and moved parallel and forward of the pinned vehicle that Anthony realized this was no delivery driver. Time seemed to slow for Anthony as he looked through the front window to see Hartley in the back seat, reading his paper, unmoved by the commotion caused by the Sprinter. Switching his attention back toward the van driver, he noticed something small and white in his left hand. He appeared to be looking not at Hartley and not at the Suburban, but at the people on the sidewalk. It was only then that Anthony realized what was happening. He had to get Hartley out of the car. That was his last thought, before a sound he had not heard since his basic demolition training in the Marine Corps 35 years earlier erupted from the Sprinter. Fire, deafening noise, and a shockwave unlike anything he had ever experienced reverberated through his body and sucked the air from his lungs. The congressman's Suburban rocked onto its side against the curb while the front of the apartment building absorbed an impact that Anthony thought might take down the building. Wide-eyed, he stared at the formerly peaceful street that had just been transformed into a war zone. When he turned back toward the bearded man, all he saw was traffic and chaos. Chapter 69. Reese turned the corner and ran east, blending in amongst the masses of humanity desperate to flee the site of the explosion. He couldn't help but think of similar images from television 16 years earlier, images that sent Reese and his brothers to far corners of the globe in search of those responsible. Improvise, Reese.
He saw an opportunity and reacted instantly, grabbing a wide-brimmed black hat from the head of a Hasidic Jew jogging in front of him. The man turned instantly to his left to recover his sacred hat, but Reese brushed past the man on his right side and continued forward. The sheep-like crowd sensed the lack of danger and began to slow as human curiosity started to set in. Much to Reese's shock, people began pulling out their phones to check news sites, take video, and even to post to social media accounts, lest anyone miss a single moment of their shared life experience. Getting caught carrying a gun in New York City was an absolute no-go. As much as Reese loved his Glock 19 for its reliability and durability, it was a little big to conceal from a trained eye. Getting spotted by a sharp-eyed NYPD officer for carrying a concealed handgun would bring his mission to a screeching halt. He'd have a tough time talking his way out of the encounter, and shooting it out with the cops here was a really bad plan. He wasn't about to go unarmed at this point, though, so he had compromised firepower for concealment. The Glock 43 was a compact, single-stack magazine version of the larger Austrian pistol that shared its 9mm chambering. Reese's pistol had been extensively customized by Zev Technologies in Oxnard, California, and Reese could shoot it almost as well as he could its larger relative. With the slim but powerful handgun in an appendix holster, Reese could defend himself and potentially break contact if it were absolutely necessary. He desperately hoped that wouldn't be the case. Reese slowed his pace to a jog and eased to the edge of the crowd, switching to a brisk walk. He turned north down an alley, placing the hat atop his head. Removing his backpack as he walked, he took out a black Arc'teryx fleece and pulled it on. The disguise wouldn't bear close scrutiny, but along with his full beard, it would work at first glance. The alley took Reese to another eastbound street where he turned right and began looking for a cab. It had been years since he'd visited New York, and it took him a few tries before he decoded the meaning of the light bars on the taxi's roofs. Finally spotting an empty car, Reese walked out in front of it to block its path. The driver stopped and he quickly climbed inside.
"Brooklyn, Best Buy on Belt Parkway,"
Reese said in his best Eastern European accent, uncertain whether his mimicry even matched his preposterous disguise. The ordinarily bad Manhattan traffic turned to near-instant gridlock as news of the explosion spread across the borough. The rumor mill came alive with speculation, half-truths and blatant lies, panic spreading like a wildfire in a gale. What should have been a short drive turned into a painful crawl. The driver, who appeared to be from somewhere in Central Africa, turned up the local news station to listen to the breaking story. Reese braced for a description of the bomber and lowered his head, as if in prayer. It struck him that now wouldn't be a terrible time to ask the man upstairs for help.
"Please, God, all I've ever asked of you was to watch over my family. Let me avenge their deaths."
Initial eyewitness accounts indicated the perpetrator was a male of Middle Eastern descent. The tall American of Scandinavian ancestry, dressed as a Jew from Eastern Europe, had to chuckle at the description. Maybe Hartley has a point about our xenophobia after all. As they crossed into Brooklyn, Reese reached into the pocket of his jeans for the last of his throwaway cell phones. It was a flip phone without the benefit of a full keyboard, so it took him longer than normal to type out the text message.
"Pick me up at Mom's in 30.
Darkness came early this time of year, and so by the time the taxi made its way into the shopping area near Coney Island, night had fallen. Reese paid the hefty cab fare in cash, leaving a 20% tip, enough not to be remembered as a guy who stiffed the driver but not generous enough to stand out. It would probably be too late by the time anyone tracked down the driver, but there was no use taking unnecessary chances. The other side could always get lucky. He climbed out of the cab into the chilly night air. The temperature had dropped into the high 40s and it was starting to rain.
Perfect.
Reese stood for a moment and pretended to use his cell phone as the cab sped away in search of his next fare. Reese walked south, past a hotel, a wholesale club, and a Mercedes dealership. As he passed through a relatively dark area between the lights of two businesses, he took the ill-fitting hat from his head and flung it like a frisbee off into the weeds.
He retrieved a battered ball cap from one of his old platoons out of his pack and pulled it on low and tight. The insignia would be meaningless to all but a few people, most of whom were dead.
See you soon, boys.
Reese turned right on Bay 41st Street and headed toward the water. Airports and train stations were full of cops, surveillance cameras, and sophisticated software to track the comings and goings of passengers. Marinas, however, were what Churchill would have called the soft underbelly of transit, with minimal, if any, security or surveillance. The Marine Basin Marina was scheduled to close at 5 o'clock p.m., and the employees were too engrossed in their closing rituals to notice a solitary figure walk through the gate in the rainy darkness. Reese could see the running lights of his exfil ride floating just off the end of the marina's long pier. The boat, expertly driven, pulled close as he approached, the driver controlling the throttles to keep the vessel from smashing into the concrete pilings in the choppy waters. Reese walked off the end of the pier and landed on the deck with well-practiced grace. The driver seemed to take no notice as he accelerated the boat away from the shoreline.
"Thanks for the ride, Rafe," Reese said as he approached the driver at the helm. "Don't mention it, eh?"
Rafe Hastings replied without taking his eyes off the water. He spoke with a slight accent that most would assume to be South African. Reese knew better. Chapter 70. Fisher's Island, New York. The 38-foot protector Tauranga bobbed in the dark waters of Fisher's Island Sound, between Fisher's Island, New York, and Ram Island, Connecticut. Located at the eastern tip of Long Island Sound, Fisher's Island had long been associated with the military as a base for naval forces up to and through World War II. These days, it was the lesser-known cousin to the Hamptons. Though at only 9 miles long and 1 mile wide, it was arguably more exclusive. Once a guardian to the waters of the northeastern United States, it was now an escape for the ultra-rich, with two private clubs and one of the most sought-after rounds of golf on Earth. With less than 250 year-round residents, it was the perfect escape for the country's most discerning families. In late October, few lights burned in the homes spaced generously along the shoreline. Reese had his thermal imager focused on one in particular. They had timed it for a slack tide, as currents were exceptionally strong here. There was very little maritime traffic tonight due to the wind and weather, which both continued to build, but the triple 350-horsepower outboard motors of the Protector had no trouble holding station in the rough seas. Originally built for the New Zealand Coast Guard, its ridged fiberglass hull and surrounding inflatable chambered hypalon tubes made it strikingly similar to the ribs that SEALs had used in maritime operations for most of Reese's time in the Navy. Though, this one was built with luxury, not effectiveness in war, as its guiding design principle. Rain pelted down around them, but neither man seemed to care. Good operating weather. Rafe manned the helm. He had been quiet most of the trip. At 2 inches taller than Reese's 6 feet, but with shoulders to match, he looked like an MMA fighter trapped in a cowboy's body who somehow found himself captaining a ship at sea. Wisps of dirty blonde hair snuck from beneath a black watch cap-style beanie and betrayed the fact that this guy did not spend much time in a boardroom. The scar that ran from the corner of his left eye and ended just shy of his upper lip gave his rugged features a menacing look. Even though it was dark, his green eyes pierced the night like a nocturnal predator.
"Okay, I've seen what I needed to," said Reese, lowering his thermal. "Take me around to windward. I don't want to come right in on them. They probably expect that coming from a frogman."
Rafe nodded, but didn't say a word. He pushed the throttle forward and the agile boat sprang to life, easily handling the choppy waves and turbulent weather for which it was engineered. Deftly piloting around the eastern tip of the island, he slowed his advance and maneuvered the Protector west. Anyone looking from shore would think he was just one more rich yachtsman who didn't check the weather and had bitten off more than he could chew, now making his way back home to Long Island in his expensive toy, choosing to avoid the notoriously hard-to-navigate shallow rocks of the Sound termed the clumps.
This is good, Reese told his larger companion. Just over a mile offshore.
Katie had accessed her work database and spent hours sifting through public and private records of the Hartleys, attempting to piece together the SecDef's most probable location. There had to be a place off the books where she would hole up. Then, Katie found it. Hidden deep within the convoluted financials of the Hartley Family Foundation was a write-off for a foundation planning office. The address was a post office box in New York, but a phone number listed on one of the mandatory 501c3 forms had a Connecticut prefix. Katie narrowed her search to counties bordering Connecticut and cross-referenced those with geodata location information embedded in the